One of the most wicked individuals who ever lived was Titus. Titus was sent to destroy the second base of Migdash, and Titus was an individual who loved power, who was vicious, barbaric, and he laid siege to Yerushalayim, and eventually he broke in. And when he broke into Yerushalayim, one of his first stops was to head straight for the base of Migdash, and he entered into the Kodshei Kodshim, but he wasn't just there to destroy the base of Migdash, to conquer the Klal Yisrael. He was there to be mevazeh, to embarrass, to degrade, to debase Hashem himself. He took a harlot, a prostitute, he took a Sefer Torah, and in the Kodshei Kodshim, he performed a sin. He then took a sword and stabbed the parochus, which stopped the person normally from walking into the Kodshei Kodshim. And a miracle happened, and blood began spouting out, and he took it as a sign, aha, I killed God. At which point he took the parochus, which is a beautiful, magnificent tapestry, he used it as sort of a cradle, he took all the kalim, the golden kalim from the base of Migdash, he left his soldiers there, and he set back to sail back to Rome. Gemara Gittin tells us that while he's on the boat, on the ship on the way back, a major typhoon begins rushing at the boat, and the boat itself looks like it's going to be destroyed. Titus should have recognized that Hashem was sending him a message. Titus recognized that it was Hashem, but he didn't quite get the message. Titus went up to the foredeck, pointed a finger to Shemayim and said, aha, it's the Jewish God. I see, you're very powerful at the sea. You have trouble with Paro, what do? You drown him at the sea. Sisera, you have problems with? You drown him at the sea. If you're so powerful, come to dry land and do battle with me. At which point, Gemara tells us that a bas kol comes out, a heavenly voice that proclaims, Russia, ben beno shel eshev ha-Russia, wicked one. You want to do battle? We'll do battle. But you won't battle with me. I have a birya katana, a very small creature. You're going to go on land and do battle with it. What is that small creature, the Gemara tells us? Some sort of small flea, mosquito, tiny little fly. When Titus lands on shore, a very small flying insect enters his nose and penetrates into his brain. For 7 years, this little insect ate away at his brain, and one of the miracles of his existence was that Titus remained alive in pain, being tortured with this very small little insect growing and growing, eating away at the inside of his brain. And at the end of 7 years, when it was clear that Titus was about to die, he gathered those around him and he said, listen to me, I'm going to leave this earth. I'm going to die. When I die, take my body and burn it, and take the ashes and scatter them over the seven seas so that the Jewish God doesn't take punishment against me. And in fact, that's what they did. When he died, they burnt his body, scattered it over the seven seas. And in one sense, that would sound like the end of our story. But the Gemara in Gittin goes on to tell us that there was more to the story. Because while Titus was a tremendously wicked individual, he had a nephew who was not so wicked at all. If you look on the inside of every Chumash, there's Targum Unculus. Targum Unculus is one of the most masterful works because the job of Targum is to take the essence of the Torah, all of Pirushim, all of the depth, and put it into a different language without watering it down. And it took a master of Kula Torah Kula to do it. The Targum that became probably the most accepted is Targum Unculus. And in fact, in almost every Chumash that you'll open in Shul, you'll see the Targum of Unculus. And while Unculus was a tremendous tzaddik, tremendous Talmid Chacham, that was not his beginning, he was the nephew of Titus. And at a certain point, Unculus, who was then a Gentile, was making the decision whether you should be Megayer, whether you should convert or not. And he wasn't sure. But at this point already, his uncle Titus was dead. So Gemara tells us that he brought him up in the Gida. The Gida is a type of black magic via which you're able to speak to those who are in the next world. He brought up Titus ben Egida and he asked him the following question. Man choshev b'hu alma? Who is choshev? Who is important in the next world? Amalei, Titus answered him, Yisrael, the Klal Yisrael. Ma'olad v'uki b'hu? Uncle, should I cling to them? Should I become Jewish? Amalei, Titus said back, Amilu nafshem l'matzei sekumi. There are many, many laws. Very, very difficult. You'll never fulfill it. What you should do, my nephew, is zil igir b'hu. Go fight them. Go wage war against the Jews. Why? Havi reisha, you'll be head. Hayut tzer el rosh. Hashem will never give over his people to a lowly nation. Wage war against the Jews and you'll know that you'll be on top. You'll know that you'll be powerful because God will never give over his people to a lowly nation. Therefore, you'll be rosh and that's what you should do. And then Unkelus asked one more question of his uncle. Dina dehu gavra b'mai. Uncle, what is your judgment? What is happening to you now? Amalei, Tita said, b'mai depasik anafshe, they do to me that which I paskined on myself, that which I determined on myself should be. Kol yuma, every day, machtese lekitme, every day they gather together my ashes, v'dainile, they judge it, v'kalle, and they burn it, umabandra shavayami, and they spread it out on the seven seas. Every day I go through a torture, a living gehenim. Every day I suffer. And that's the Gemara. And now let's ask what I consider the obvious question on this Gemara. Right now, you and I can have various thoughts, various feelings and emotions. One minute I'll feel this way, one minute I'll feel another way. But either way, you can't tell what I'm thinking. You can't tell what's going on in my heart. You could hear my words. You can tell my actions. But you can't tell what's really going on inside me. And I can't see what's really going inside of you. And the reality is that each of us are cloaked in this heavy, heavy physicality. The I who think, the I who feels, am wrapped in this body. And because I'm wrapped in this body, you can't see me. And because I'm wrapped in this body, there are constant different needs and desires and conflicting things that are going on within me. We described earlier the Nefesh Bahami, Nefesh Sichli, and various desires and traits. There's need for honor. There's need for arrogance. There's laziness. There are many, many different traits that are bubbling up, many different desires that are constantly coming upon me. I have a desire to do what's good, what's right, what's proper. I also have a desire for everything physical. I have a desire to be generous, and I have a desire to be totally self-centered. And I am in constant flux, and I am in constant change, and I'm utterly confused. One minute, I'll be in shul davening, and I'll see Hashem right there. The next minute, I'm gone, running after some desire or arrogant, self-fulfilling concept. But as long as I'm in this body, I'm mixed up, and I'm confused. The problem with this Gemara is that this Gemara is speaking when Titus is no longer in his body. He's dead. The body's buried in the ground, and his nephew brings him up in the Gida and asks him a question. His nephew brings him up to ask him as a wise man, because he was wise, advice. And what's the advice that he gives his nephew? Don't become Jewish, no. Don't do that. Too hard, too difficult. What should you do? Fight against them. The question is, how could Titus, in the Olam HaEmes, in the world of truth, say something like that? He sees HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He sees the truth. He understands that Hashem loves the Jewish people. The proof is because the first question that Uncle S asks him is, who's on charge? Who's up high? In the world to come, who's Choshev? Yisrael. No question. Of course the Klal Yisrael. And of course the Tzaddikim sit closer. And the more holy and more pious, the closer you are to Hashem. And the less pious, the further away. No question. He understands that. He sees that. That's what he says to his nephew. So he gets it. He understands because he's in the world of truth. He's no longer fooled, no longer living in delusions, no longer living confused. He sees the truth. He recognizes that Hashem is the creator and maintainer of all physicality. He sees that Hashem is the master of all and the maintainer of all. He sees Hashem right there. And if it could be in front of the Kisya Kavod, as Hashem is sustaining him, keeping him in existence, as Hashem is watching, he gives advice to his nephew that is utterly ridiculous. Fight against the Jews. Why? Because for the few short years you're alive, you'll be Barosh, you'll be ahead. Titus, that's ridiculous. It's absurd. Hashem is watching. You know the truth. You understand that that's going to damage your nephew. You understand he's going to suffer. Why are you giving him such false, foolish advice? And what makes it even more difficult is the final question that Uncleus asked Titus. Uncleus says to Titus, "Sir, uncle, what is your judgment?" "Exactly that which I paskin to myself. Every day they gather my ashes, judge me, burn me, and scatter them to the seven seas." Obviously, that's euphemistic. He has no body. They don't burn it. They don't scatter it. But if you understand the physical pain of being burnt alive, the physical pain of having your body consumed by flames, that is a mushal to what he goes through on a daily basis, being judged, being burnt, being scattered, the awesome Gehenim that he describes. So if he just told his nephew, "That's the pain that I suffer daily," why is he giving his nephew advice to do exactly that which will bring his nephew to the same pain that he's in? Attack the Jews. You'll be Barosh, you'll be ahead, because God won't give his people to a lowly people. You'll be the top nation. And when you die, you're going to burn like me. There's no body, there's no goof, there's no clouds of physicality, there's no darkness. How is it possible that Titus could say something so blind, so foolish, when he's in the world of truth? And I'd like to share with you what I believe the answer to this question is. And I think when we answer this question, we'll get a much better understanding to what actually happens when we leave this earth. And to do this, let's understand the following. Let's imagine that I have a desire, whatever the desire may be. Let's imagine for a minute I have a desire to eat a peanut butter sandwich. Okay, and I give in to the desire. Not a big deal. Let's assume that peanut butter sandwiches are not forbidden by the Torah. They're not treif. They're not damaging to my neshama. Not a big deal. I gave in to a little desire to eat. Maybe it was fine. Maybe even a mitzvah. Okay. But let's assume for a minute that the activity that I gave in to was a little bit different. Let's assume that Hashem forbade that activity. And the reason why Hashem forbade that activity is, as the Chovos Levavos has explained to us, because it gives an inordinate strengthening to the Nefesh HaBahami. There are certain activities that you do that strengthen the Nefesh HaBahami more than others. There are certain actions that give it more energy, more strength. Wearing shatnez, wool and linen mixed together, gives the Nefesh HaBahami more strength. Now, you need to be a scientist of the soul to understand that, but as a mushal, that brings it much closer. We don't eat predators. Klei Yochar explains that all of the kosher animals, there are 10 animals that are kosher to be eaten, not a one of them is a predator. Why? Because when you ingest the meat of the animal, part of the nefesh is absorbed into you. A predatory animal is aggressive. It's toref, it rips apart, it's a hunter. It's a very cruel, vicious animal. And if you would consume some of that flesh, some of that nefesh would get into you, and some of that nature would become part of you. Your nefesh HaBahami would become more aggressive, more cruel, and it would be more difficult for you to become a refined, holy Jew. All of the forbidden activities damage me, and the Chovos Levavos explains to us that most of the Isuri HaTorah are because they give a special strength to the Nefesh HaBahami. So let's imagine for a minute that peanut butter sandwiches were really damaging. And let's imagine the Torah gave a specific losa, say, don't eat peanut butter sandwiches. And let's assume that one day I had a sudden desire for peanut butter sandwich. I want it. I don't. I do. I don't. I don't. The Torah says I can't, but I want it. And I give in. And I ate that peanut butter sandwich. So what happened? So number one, obviously, I made my Nefesh HaBahami a bit stronger, because I gave in and damaged my Nefesh HaBahami. But additionally to that, I made the desire for peanut butter sandwiches stronger within me. You see, within the human, there are natural instinctive desires. And when you give into them, they become stronger. The nefesh bahami becomes more dominant, and that desire itself becomes stronger. And now the next time when I'm walking by a store and I see a sign for peanut butter sandwiches, well, guess what? I'm going to be a little bit hungrier, desire a little bit more, and I'm going to want it a little bit more. Now, let's assume that I give in to this desire on a regular basis. I eat peanut butter sandwiches all day, every day, on a regular basis. I ingest them and ingest them and ingest them. I constantly consume them. So what happens? So obviously, the desire for peanut butter sandwiches become stronger. Obviously, I need them more, I want them more. But there's something else that happens on a deeper level. I make that desire part of me. You see, when I give in, I now want that peanut butter sandwich. We gave the mushel of the yerks. When my son said to me that, Abba, isn't the Yetzer Hara like that yerk? In Animorphs, there's a little slug that climbs into your brain and takes over. And my son said to me, see, that's the Yetzer Hara. You don't want to do it, but it makes you do it. You want to go left, and it makes you go right. You want to go forward, it makes you go backwards. That's the Yetzer Hara. And again, I didn't say it to my son at the time because he was a little guy, but that's a terrible mushel for the Yetzer Hara. Because when I desire the peanut butter sandwich, I don't want it, I do, I don't, I do, and I give in, I made a conscious choice. I decided that I want it, and I now have changed. I now have made peanut butter sandwiches more a part of my desire, more a part of me. I've made the decision that I want peanut butter sandwich, and I made the I want peanut butter sandwiches more a part of me. And I'd like to share with you a very significant distinction. In chemistry, there's something called a suspension, and there's something called a solution, and they're very different. And I'll explain to you what I mean. If you take water and add a cup of sugar, take a pitcher of water and a cup of sugar and stir it very well. The sugar is dissolved into the water. And if you did a good job of stirring it, every single glass of water that you'll take will have an equally distributed amount of sugar. It'll all taste sweet. And to your eye, it looks like the water is completely made with the sugar mixed into one entity. But they're not one entity. That's a suspension. The sugar has temporarily become suspended in the solution called water, and it's kind of like mixed up in there. But if you let that water sit overnight, you'll see that the sugar tends to kind of settle to the bottom. And if you let it sit for a week, it settles more and settles more. Because even though the sugar is mixed in at the moment when you stir it up, it remains a suspension. That means the sugar is suspended in the water mix, but it really hasn't dissolved completely, and it hasn't become bonded with the water. But when you take an object, when you take a mixture and you cook it, when you expose it to heat, then oftentimes that same mix will become a solution where they actually bond on a molecular level, where if it could be, and this might not be the perfect mushel, but if it could be the sugar and the water would bond together molecularly so that it's no longer a suspension that's separated easily, but it now has become a new entity. It's a new compound bound together and is very, very difficult to separate. A suspension are two objects that are mixed together, but they're really not bound one to the other. A solution is when the objects literally become bonded, the molecular structure changes, and they become a new unit. And while this may not be as clear in terms of chemistry, it's a very significant and very important mushel for what happens when we die. I assume, most of us, I believe, assume, that right now I have desires and hungers and appetites, but when I die, Baruch Hashem, they'll be gone. Remember, they came from my body. They came from my nefesh bahami. My nefesh bahami is dead, and I'll be there in the Olam HaEmes, and I'll be there in the world to come without any of these desires, without any of these taivas, and I'll be free from them. Baruch Hashem, I'm finally done with them. And that might be true unless you allow taiva to rule over you. The Chef Schmeitzer in his introduction explains that when you give in to desires on a regular basis, if you give in all the time, then it becomes like a solution. It's not a suspension. It's not like that desire was separate from you and you allowed it to win that one time. If you give in and give in, give in and give in, it becomes one with you. You now have it in you, but no longer because it's from the Nefesh HaBahami. It's now part of the new essence called you. It's become a new entity, and you now have that desire regardless of your body, regardless of your Nefesh HaBahami. If you give into taiva desires occasionally, when you did it, you had the desire, it remains a suspension, meaning to say there are two parts of me that engaged in that action. There's a part of me that wanted it, a part of me that didn't. I was in battle and I gave in, I caved. But it remains something separate from me. The desire and I are not totally a new compound. If I remain in that state when I die, then the desires die with the body. But if I become a Baal Taiva, if I give in regularly and regularly allow these desires to become part of me, they bond to me, they become one unit, and when the body dies, I still desire them. And if you'd like a mushal, a mahadava dome, to what this is comparable to, imagine the following. People who lose limbs, whether it be an arm or a leg, will often describe pain. A man will be in the hospital, a war injury, he lost his arm, and he'll scream out, "Nurse, nurse, my arm is killing me, there are pins and needles, it's horrible." And the nurse gently tries to explain to the man that he has no arm. That arm is cut off. It's no longer there. But the brain doesn't yet register that. And he has phantom pains. He has pains in an arm that isn't there. But it's killing him. And he feels the tingling. And he feels the flame. And he's in serious pain as 1,000 needles prod the arm that isn't there. Another mushal. Have you ever seen an old man, what they call a dirty old man? An old man, he could be a Bowery bum or whoever, and he lusts after women. And imagine we have an old man, he's grimy and gritty, he's 85 plus, and he's sitting there, and he's making rude comments and whistling at the women that pass. And you recognize that he physically can no longer perform an act. He's an old man whose body no longer desires women, but he's made desire such a part of him that he has taiva, that he has desires, and he's lusting after things that he no longer can perform. By all rights, his desire should have died out because his body no longer desires it, but he made those desires part of him. And I'll share with you a very interesting story that Rav Elie Lapian tells over. Rav Elie Lapian tells over that in the time of the Chofetz Chaim, there was a dibuk. A dibuk is a neshama that under certain circumstances, certain conditions, is allowed to do things. And it's a neshama that's not allowed into Gan Eden, not allowed into Gehenim. It's a neshama clearly that did many, many things wrong and is in the category of a rasha. And there will be occasions when that neshama is allowed to occupy the body of a living person. It's rare, b'zman hazeh. Nowadays, it's very, very rare. I don't know if it happens at all. It used to apparently happen far more often. But in the time of the Chofetz Chaim, there was a dibbuk. And the way they knew that it was a dibbuk was because it was a young woman. And she began speaking in strange words, in strange anger tones. And she was clearly possessed. So they took this woman, put her, sort of a young woman, put her into a room. And they quickly sent for the Chofetz Chaim to exercise this dibbuk, get dibbuk out. In any case, during the time when they were waiting for the Chofetz Chaim to come, they began noticing that this dibuk, or this young woman, was speaking words of nivel peh, but horribly disgusting, lewd comments and constant references to body parts and desire and very, very crude, rude expressions. And at a certain point, one of the people said, "I don't understand. Why are you speaking that way?" And the dibuk, speaking from the body, said, "Don't you understand? This is what I made myself into. This is what I am. I desire this." And I think this concept is a very, very key concept, and I believe it helps us understand Titus. And Titus was a Russia. He wasn't just a man who gave into his anger or his desires every once in a while. He lived, ate, and drank to kill Jews, to murder. He was a beast. He was an evil, cruel, vicious individual. And he steigd, he grew in his wickedness. And when his body was buried, well, guess what? Those desires, those needs became a part of him. It wasn't a suspension. It wasn't something brought to him by his body that he occasionally gave into. He became a new compound. The anger, the jealousy, the hatred of the Jews became part of the essence of him, such that when his body died and he was no longer given the impulses because of his body, it was still a part of him. And when his nephew brought him up in the Gid and said, "Uncle, what should I do? Should I join the Jews? The Jews, oh, I hate them. I drink their blood. You should kill them." But uncle, why should I do that? "Because you'll be in power." But uncle, who wants to be in power? Power, power, that's good, power. You see, he was there in the world of truth with desires that he recognized were absurd, and yet he couldn't control himself. He knew that he was being had, knew that he was being controlled, knew that these desires were taking him, but he couldn't help this because he had made it part of him. And he told his nephew, "What you should do is attack the Jews, kill the Jews." All the while he knew what happened to him because of it, but he couldn't resist. And if you'd like to see Gehenim, I believe that's Gehenim. You see, now when I give in, I feel like it's good for me. I feel at least I'm getting pleasure. I feel I want to do it. But when my body is no longer covering me up, and when I see with total clarity what I desire, and it's nothing, but more than that, I don't have a body, and I still desire it, and I recognize the foolishness, the emptiness of this world, but I still want to do it, that's a very embarrassing moment. And especially when it's in the world of truth, in front of Hashem, and everyone else sees me with these desires and these needs. And I think that this is a very, very eye-opening and significant chazal. I'm not telling you that every time a person gives into a desire, he's going to ruin his future. All of us have desires, whether it be for anger or laziness or revenge or whatever, the gamut of all of the midos, from laziness to selfishness to everything that goes into the perfection of the human. And if occasionally you give into these, occasionally I get angry. Sometimes I'll lose my temper. It remains separate from me. What this chazal is talking about is when you make it part of your nature, and when you give in, constantly give in and give in, give in and give in, it becomes part of you. You see, it began from the Nefesh HaBahami. When you were younger, it was that desire from your body that caused it. Might have been the season of the year, might have been a particular woman, might have been a particular whatever. And originally, it came from the body. But when you give into it and give into it and give into it and give into it, it becomes a part of you. And if it becomes a part of you and you don't get rid of it, when you leave this world, it's there forever with you, joined together. And personally, this is, at least to me, one of the most frightening concepts that I can imagine. To be in the world of truth and have a fierce temper, anger, when I recognize that how foolish I am, and I recognize that there's no physical body causing this, and people see me in the state of absurd ugliness. And again, I believe that this is one of the most important, one of the most moving concepts to recognize, that as long as I fight the fight, and as long as I turn to Hashem and I say, "Hashem, please help. I'm battling. I'm fighting. I'm trying to stay away from these things. Please let it not become a part of me." And certainly if I begin winning the fight and I start doing it less, it remains in the category like sugar in the water. Eventually it separates. When I leave the body, I leave them behind. But if it becomes a solution, if it becomes bound molecularly, it becomes part of me. If I give in on a constant basis, just give in and give in and give in, what happens is it becomes a part of me and remains with me forever. However, even when you get this, And even when you understand this, this might not be as motivating as you think. And I'll share with you why. Most of us have an interesting attitude about the world to come. I like to call it travel brochures and the world to come. And I'll explain to you what I mean. If you ever watch someone pick up a travel brochure or travel magazine, and you could watch them look through the ads, pictures of beaches in Bermuda, exotic places, and you see they get that glassy sort of far eye as they look on and they see themselves there, wow, it looks so enticing. But you know, and they know, that they have no intention of ever going there. They pick up the brochure and say the beaches are so beautiful and the Alps are so gorgeous, but they know that they're never going to be there. It's a travel brochure. It's an interesting thing, but they have no intention of ever going there. And I think most people, when they think about Olam Haba, when they think about the world to come, they look at it as sort of like travel brochures. Wow, Chazal have such great descriptions. It's going to be great. Pleasures upon pleasures, without any desires, without any fights, just being close to Hashem and enjoying. Wow, the descriptions are beautiful. But it has nothing to do with me because I have no intention of being there. You see, I'll be dead. I'll be dead. My neshama, I don't know what that is anyway, but my neshama maybe will be there, but me, I'll be dead. And so this whole discussion about the world to come and whether there'll be a solution or suspension will be, it really doesn't matter because, you see, it's not me. I'll be dead. And I think this is one of the most critical mistakes that we human beings will ever make. I was a high school Rebbe for many years. And one of the first questions I would always ask the guys when I began the Musar segment of the year, I would ask the guys the following question: gentlemen, why don't you sin? But I don't mean little stuff. I mean big deal stuff. Go out there, murder, steal, every avir you've ever imagined. Now keep in mind that these were regular yeshiva guys, regular homes, well-educated. And so of course they would say, Rebbe, what do you mean? Hashem will be angry with me. I don't want Hashem to be angry with me. I say, listen to me. Throughout the millennia, many, many Rishayim, many wicked people have flourished. They've done quite well. Don't you worry about Hashem. Oh, yeah, that's true now, but my neshama is going to burn. I don't want my neshama to burn. At which point I would look at the guy and say, aha, you're telling me that there are many things that you're going to do, many things that you're not going to do, all for the sake of your neshama? Well, you listen to me. You take care of you, party, do whatever you want. Why should you work so hard so your neshama should have a good time there? You take care of you, and let your neshama burn. And that question is profound. And that question is eye-opening unless you understand what Rishon Salanta says to us. He says the biggest mistake we make about death is that we think of death as like, whoa, so different, who knows what. Like, I can't even imagine what it'll be like. Says Rishon Salanta, if you'd like to understand death, it's quite simple. Imagine I walk into a room, I hang my coat up on the hook, and I enter the room. That is death. The body is the coat. You put the coat in the ground, and I, the one inside, the one who thinks, the one who feels, separates. And I stand there in front of the Beis Nishamala. But you see, it's not my neshama, not my distant cousin, not my alter ego, some scaled-down version of me, whatever the neshama is anyway, I can't even think. It's I, with all of my thoughts, all of my memories. It's the I who occupy this body right now. The body is the coat, like an astronaut who wears a spacesuit, but the spacesuit is put away and he walks out. I am the one inside. I'm the one who feels. I'm the one who thinks. And when the body is buried, I separate. But the reality is that we don't think about death that way. Think about death like going to sleep at rest, right? If you go to the basic forest, you go to the cemetery, at rest, rest in peace. Harvey was a good man. He's in his final resting place. I'd like to share with you that rest is a very different state. If you'd like to know what rest is, imagine you break your arm, right? You're in terrible pain. You try Tylenol, codeine, Percocet, nothing helps. You're in such pain, ow, until 3 a.m., Baruch Hashem, you fall asleep, and your arm no longer bothers you because you're not there. And most people think about death like going to sleep, like at rest, I won't be there. And according to that, the question I ask those guys is very valid. Who cares? Do what you want. You don't have to work so hard. So your neshama, your distant cousin, your alter ego has a good time. You take care of you. You're going to be asleep anyway. You're going to be at rest. Your neshama is going to Burn, who cares? And Rousseau Salanta is sharing with us that you're making the biggest mistake in your life. Why? Because I am the neshama. It's not some distant, scaled-down version of me, not some alter. It is I. The body, the goof, is put in the ground, and I separate, and I stand there with all of my thoughts, all of my feelings, all of my memories, and it's I who stand there forever. And it takes a lot of work, and I recommend that you spend some time maybe listening to some of the shmuzim, shmuz number 23, which is called the Death Shmuz, in the book Stop Surviving, Start Living. I spend a lot of time on this. But if you spend time recognizing that I am not the body, and you're able to separate the two, and you begin to realize that who I am forever. The way I think, the way I feel, is what I will be even when my body's dead. And when you think about that, that's a very, very eye-opening concept. You see, the reality is that most people don't fundamentally fear death. Now, they may fear death if they could actually get their hands around and really grip it. They may fear death because it's so different, it's so foreign. But the concept of standing in front of Hashem, the Beis Shemala, doesn't scare most people. And I'll share with you why not. Because, number one, even if I realize it's going to be me and not my distant cousin, not my alter ego, even if I get through that hard part, and by the way, that's the second part. The first part that's most difficult is to realize that it's really going to happen. And strange that we are, a thinking, intelligent person can spend his whole life and never really get his hands around the fact that I will die. Now, he could quote for you the death rate of people in his age category in general health. He could tell you statistically what the odds are, but he doesn't feel it. Chavetz Chaim explains that if we had real knowledge, if we could really recognize the fact that I will die, that I will stand in front of Hashem, I would lose free will. I wouldn't have bechira. Why? Because all of the taiva in the world, all of the desire, wouldn't cause me to damage myself. And one of the forces that Hashem put into the human is blinders, that I can't really see that moment. Much like we described, Hashem put imagination into the human to allow him to believe what he wants to believe. Part of that is this insane concept that I'll never die. Oh, again, I may tell you, of course, everybody dies. I don't know anybody who shook hands with George Washington. I don't know anyone who actually saw the Gras. So in theory, I know I'll die. But in practical, emotional reality, in my operating system, I don't really feel it. And again, because as the Chofetz Chaim explains, if I had that clear understanding, I would lose free will. Why? Because I would never be tempted to sin when I would recognize that forever it's part of me. So the first problem that we have is we don't see ourselves dying. But even if we got past that, we spent many years working Musar, when we went to a levaya, we went to a funeral, we thought about it, that one day it's going to be me in the box. And we worked on, we listened to the shmuz, and we read the books, and we went through all of that stuff. We come to the second problem. The second problem is that I'll be asleep. My body will die, but I'll be at rest. I'll be blackness. It won't affect me. And that's the second obstacle, to realize it won't be black. I will be brilliantly alive and brilliantly awake, completely conscious, more acutely aware of what I am than right now. But then we come to the third problem. Third problem, and the reason why, again, most people, even when they get past this, don't really have any sense of awe or certainly trepidation of standing in front of Hashem, is because I assume what it means is we'll all be a bunch of angels surrounding Hashem. It'll be great. You'll be wearing white. I'll be wearing white. You'll have big white wings, and I'll have big white wings, and we'll dance around forever and ever, singing hymns and being in this state of celestial purity and wonderment. Now, that may be true for some, hopefully for us, but I believe that that concept is very, very false. You see, when I leave this earth, I don't suddenly become an angel in white and suddenly take on a new luster and new lore. I am who I am. The same I, the same thoughts, the same desires. Now, granted, it's different because like a blazing, brilliant sun at midday that suddenly shines, the blackness is lifted And suddenly I see the awesome value of every mitzvah that I accomplished. And I see the horrible damage of every avera I did. So my value system instantly changes. And obviously what I desire immediately changes. I only want to be close to Hashem. And I see the glory of Hashem. I see the goodness of Hashem. And I want to be like Hashem as much as I can. But I am what I shape myself into. Every situation in life molds me, shapes me. Every action, every discussion, every thought is a part of me forever. And if I've done things that were good and proper, and I shaped myself into a generous, giving, kindly person, I made myself like Hashem as much as I could, then that's who I am. And if I acted as a selfish, lousy, self-centered clout who was focused only on my own interests and desires, well, guess what? That's also who I am. And if you like a mushal, and I think this mushal is very, very powerful to define what it's like when we leave this earth, I'll share with you the following. When I was younger and word processors were first introduced to the marketplace, they were much clunkier than today's computers. The old word processors were basically a screen and a keyboard, and you had to tell the printer to do anything you wanted it to actually do. So for instance, let's say you wrote a sentence, you typed a sentence out, and you wanted to underline that sentence. What you would do is, before the sentence, you would put an open bracket, a U, and a closed bracket, and that would be a signal to the printer that that line on the screen was to be underlined when it actually printed. Let's say you wanted to bold a sentence or a word, open bracket B, closed bracket, and that would signal the printer that that particular word should be bolded. Now, in the late 80s, technology evolved, and computer scientists came up with something called WYSIWYG. WYSIWYG is an acronym. It means what you see is what you get. So what that means is, now when you open up Microsoft Word and you click on the B, it bolds that word, and on the screen you see the word in bold. If you want to underline the word, you click on the U, and it underlines the word. What you see on the screen is what you get in the printer. What you see is what you get. And I believe that that's a very apt parable for the world to come. You see, when my body's put in the ground and I separate, I leave. The curtain comes down, and what you see is what you get. I don't magically change. I don't suddenly get this pixie and dust that's sprinkled upon me and I'm a holy angel. Whatever level of purity and holiness I reached is what I am forever. And whatever I didn't is what I didn't get forever. The music stops, the curtain comes down, and it's freeze. As you are forever. And now I want to explain to you one of the most misunderstood concepts in the world. In the Catholic Church, purgatory is feared. In fact, you can't even say the word hell. I once made a mistake of saying it as a high school rabbi. I never knew this. I wasn't brought up in a Catholic school. And so I once used the expression, you know, if you do such and such thing, you end up going to hell. And one of the guys said, Rebbe, how could you say nivel peh? Now again, I was brought up in a Jewish, you know, home, Jewish school, and the concept of Gehenim wasn't a dirty word, so I didn't know that you're not allowed to say that, and I made the mistake. I since learned that we have different hasagas, different concepts. But I'd like to share with you the difference between the Jewish understanding of Gehenim and the outside world's understanding. In the outside world's understanding, God is okay. You know, he created a world that, you know, did about as good as he could do, and there are the evil forces that God wishes weren't there, but, you know, God really isn't in charge. You can't control them, you know. In fact, some of them actually believe that there's an archangel. God made this archangel, and he turned bad, and it became Satan, and Satan tempts man to do bad, and God sits back there, Nebuchadnezzar, what are you going to do? But in the end, God wins because he gets purgatory. If you follow the Satan, you're going to get burned, and God will wreak vengeance upon you, wreak havoc upon your soul. For eternity, you will burn. Now, if you like fairy tales, you can listen to those, and they sound very, well, they don't sound entertaining, but they are certainly creative. Chazal tell us that it has no connection whatsoever to Gehenim. Gehenim is a chesed, a huge mercy that Hashem exhibits to his beloved Klal Yisrael. Why? Because Gehenim is a time period where I am able to somehow cleanse things that were put into me and don't belong there. It's a cleaning period. It's a special chesed. Is it painful? It's horribly painful, unimaginably painful. But there are no fires because there's no body. And the Rishonim explained to us the Eish HaGehenim, the fire of Gehenim, is busha. For a time period, I'm allowed to contemplate and understand the folly of my ways. Fool that I was. I bought into this nonsense. It was literally just smoke and mirrors. It was a mirage. And it was such light little things. They came to me as little spider webs, and I gave into them. What did I do? And that horrible sense of embarrassment, of busha, is somehow machaper and changes some things. It removes some of the damage. It won't make me bigger than I am. It won't do for me things that I didn't do. But some of the damage that's done, it can eliminate. And I believe that this concept is also fundamental for us to understand. You see, the reality is that we are battling a battle that is major. It's a fight for our existence. It's a fight for eternity. The Satan is allowed out of the box, and the fight is huge. And the one thing we have to keep ever in front of our eyes is that Hashem wants us to succeed. And Hashem gives us tremendous help and tools to succeed. And our main goal has to be to keep fighting the fight, keeping in it, and understand I may not win it now, but my eye is on the prize, and that prize is eventually vanquishing, getting rid of this. The danger comes in when you give up. The danger when it comes in when you say, forget it, it's too hard to fight, I'm quitting. And you allow Taiva to become a part of you, and it rages and rages and becomes more and more, and you and it become one. And if that happens, Gehenim can't help, because you and it are one. You're now a solution, a new compound. You see, if you leave this earth with desires because you didn't conquer them, but they're a suspension, meaning I didn't want it, but I did, I was always torn. If you leave in that state, Gehenim might very well be able to clean it up and get rid of it, and for eternity, it's gone. And whatever levels of Kiddush and holiness you reached is yours forever. But if you allowed it to become a compound within you, if it became you and it became one, and it became bound to you, Gehenim can't help because it's part of you. Titus is sitting there with all of the anger, all of the hatred. If a person allows himself to become a Baal Taiva, where Taiva becomes a part of his essence, then it's part of him forever and nothing can separate it because it's a new compound and it can't be removed. As long as you're fighting the fight, and as long as you're in there battling, it's a part, you're still failing, and it may be true, and you may even die that way. You may never win. But it's not a part of you. It's a suspension. It's something that you do that you hate, and something that you do that you wish you didn't do, something that you're trying to eradicate. And as long as a person stands in front of Hashem and says, Hashem, I don't want to do this, please help me. And he's fighting the fight and really battling, it remains in that category of something apart. And even if you don't perfect yourself now, you mispalel, Hashem will help. And hopefully, Gehenim takes care of it. You certainly have time now to grow, to accomplish, to change. Tshuva in our world eliminates it. But even if it doesn't, there's always hope. The only danger that a person really gets into is if he leaves this earth having given up and says, forget it, it becomes a part of him, and he can't ever change. And if you'd like to understand this, I want to close with one last mashal that I think is very, very powerful and very, very eye-opening. In the year 2000, the Steinmetz Group unveiled its ultimate millennium collection of diamonds. The Steinmetz Group is one of the largest diamond holders, diamond manufacturers in the world. And this group of diamonds was the most classic, most beautiful group of diamonds arranged. And the center of it was what they called the Millennium Star. The Millennium Star is a 200-carat diamond. It's considered flawless. It's actually not flawless under the microscope. It does have minor flaws, but it's considered internally and externally flawless. It's cut to perfect proportion, and again, it weighs 200 carats. It is a magnificent diamond, If you know diamonds, it takes your breath away. It's astonishing. Its clarity, its color, its brilliance is beyond description. This diamond did not begin as a beautiful, gorgeous, clear diamond. In South Africa, in one of the major mines, they found a diamond that in the rough actually weighed 777 carats. It was huge. But a diamond in the rough, hard to know what it is. Hard to know what you can cut it into. And it could be, when you cut open this diamond, you have nothing. Could be you have fragments. Could be you have dirt. Could be very, very difficult to know. So the Steinmetz group, when they first mined this diamond, gave it over to the what they believed were the best team of cutters in the world. It was headed by an Israeli-born fellow, Nir Livnat. He was the managing director of Ascat Diamonds, and they were given the task of cutting this diamond. Nir Livnat spent 3 years studying this diamond. They made computer models. They made all types of angles and different stress fracture tests, and they did every imaginable test that they could, and the actual diamond was cut by laser. It couldn't be cut with actual tools, cut by laser. And after 3 years, everything was set up. The diamond is contained now in a near sterile room. It's almost like a laboratory where they don't want any outside dust or anything there because it could interfere with the cut. And the day of the cut, Nir Livnat pushes the button, the diamond laser is cut, and out comes this near-perfect 200-carat gorgeous diamond. I've heard it told that at that moment, Nir Livnat passed out. 3 years he spent studying it, 3 years knowing whether it's going to be the most famous diamond in the world or it might just be worthless, who knows what, because you could study it under a microscope, and you could study it carefully, but until you cut it, you don't know how it really comes out. The cut happened, and it was perfect, flawless, gorgeous, astonishing diamond. Now, I want to ask you a question. Nir Livnat passed out when he saw the gorgeous diamond. What if, when the laser finished cutting, a perfectly proportioned diamond came out, but it was black? What if the center of it was black coal? Perfect diamond, proportionally. All the cuts were done right, but smack in the center is a big lump of blackness. Instead of being the world's famous diamond, it would have been nothing. They would have used it maybe to polish metal. They would have used it for industrial diamonds. It would have been worthless. But you don't know until you cut the diamond and remove the rough what comes out. If you'd like a muscle to what it's like when we leave this earth, I walk around, you walk around, I don't know who you are, you don't know who I am, but imagine for a minute that I spent my life working, growing, accomplishing, learning, davening, giving staka, doing chet, and I grew and I grew, and I look like a 200-carat diamond. But I leave this earth, and the inside of me is black. Yes, I spent years growing the diamond, and I became a 200-carat diamond, but the inside is black as coal. For eternity, I will regret that. You see, does every diamond have a flaw? Yes. And as long as the flaws are small, and they're just little things, it's fine. A diamond could be 2 carats, 10 carats, could be 100 carats. With a flaw, it's worth a king's ransom. But if the inside of the diamond is black, if there's coal inside it, the diamond is almost worthless. And my friends, that's exactly the point. We're going to spend our lives working, growing, accomplishing, fighting the fights. As long as my desires remain something that are apart from me, even if I give in, even if I fall, even if I fail, if I'm fighting the fight, they remain separate from me. I keep them apart. Will I get rid of all of them? Maybe not. Will it take Gehenna to finally clean them? Maybe. But the point is, they're not a part of me. The minute I give in totally, the minute I cave and say this is too hard to fight, what I'm doing is I'm allowing them to become a compound with me. I and them are the same, much like Titus, who desired to kill the Jews even when he realized it was so foolish, much like an old man who lusts and hungers. Could you imagine the embarrassment of everyone seeing me? You see, in the world to come, we're all there. I'm there, you're there. I don't have to speak to you, you don't have to speak to me. You understand me, I understand you. You want to call it telepathically? Telepathic is a poor description. I know exactly who you are, you know exactly who I am. And imagine that we see an old man lusting and hungry. Fool, we don't have bodies. There's no taiva because there's no body. But he's sitting there with his hunger and his appetites. And there's another guy, anger. There's no boss. There's no, but it's a part of him. And if you'd like one of the most motivational tools to use, just imagine the following. You're growing, you're accomplishing, you're making your diamond bigger and bigger. Make sure that it's not black on the inside. As long as you fight the fight, as long as you daven to Hashem and ask Hashem, please help, and you keep battling it, even if you give in, it's still part from you. It's a suspension. It may look like it's you, but it's like sugar in the water. It can be separated. It's when you become a Baal Taiva, when you totally give in, totally cave, allow it to become huge and totally conquer you. That's when the diamond itself becomes black. It remains with you for eternity. May Hashem grant us the wisdom, understanding, and the strength to put this into practice.